Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 383, another of our interviews with Kevin Coogan, the author of, among other works, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, published in soft cover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, we're recording this on October 14th of 2002. I'm speaking, Kevin, I guess one could say the thermostat, the geopolitical thermostat is just about all the way up, as high as it could go, and a lot of things are helping to make things hot, and certainly the conflict between Islamism, or Islamofascism as I call it, and the West, the United States in particular, is occupying center stage, and there are individuals whose roles in this tapestry or this mosaic are important, though not necessarily all that well recognized. And a person whose career overlaps a lot of different things that I've spoken about on this program, and whose works are not as peripheral to the events of September 11th as one might think, and that's a guy named Horst Mahler. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Horst Mahler, give us some background, and how he weighed in on the events of September 11th.
Sure. Horst Mahler is a fascinating figure, and in Germany, he's both famous and notorious. The reason being is that he is an example of a former extreme leftist who made, in the 1990s especially, a radical turn to the far right. But in so doing, he maintained the extreme anti-Americanism of his earlier leftist beliefs. Now, Mahler created a good deal of controversy after September 11th when he issued a statement entitled, I believe, Independence Day, being a sort of a pun on the movie Independence Day when a flying saucer comes down and destroys the White House, among other things.
It destroyed much of New York, too, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's right, it did, yes. Yes, exactly. The statement that Mahler put out, which was widely distributed on the internet and translated and reached various right-wing sites, was essentially an endorsement of Al-Qaeda and the attacks on America. Mahler, of course, did not embrace the ideology of extreme Islamism, but he essentially argued that the enemy of our enemies is our friend, and there was no act too extreme to oppose the United States. So, unlike other rightist groups and individuals that were somewhat hesitant right after September 11th, Mahler jumped into the fray applauding the destruction of the two towers.
Now, Mahler has an interesting background. He, as you mentioned, was a far leftist. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about the Red Army faction or Baader-Meinhof gang and his liaisons with them.
Sure. This is a complicated story, and it's a story that I realized just how complicated it was when I met with Horst Mahler. I met with Mahler in the spring, this spring, in Berlin. He lives in a suburb of Berlin called Kleinmachnow. And so we spoke for about 3 or 4 hours, and I tried to unravel some of the mystery of his politics and his activity. Essentially, Mahler was born in the East, and his family, during World War II, or in the aftermath of World War II, fled to the West. When he was in his 20s, he became very much involved as a traditional radical in German left-wing affairs and in the what they call the extra-parliamentary left of the 1960s. He first became important as a radical lawyer. He was a member of the German equivalent of, say, something like the National Lawyers Guild, which made a profession of defending radicals attacked by the police. And as a lawyer, and as a very smart lawyer, he made contacts with many of the most extreme German leftists of that time, because these were the people who were always getting arrested. Now, sometime in around 1969, 1970, he became involved with both Andreas Baader and Ulrike Meinhof, who were the founding members of the Baader-Meinhof gang, which is also known as the Red Army faction. Some people have argued that it was actually Mahler himself who was the sort of the third part of the triangle, and that Mahler's role in actually forming the RAF was extremely significant. In other words, many people think that he actually was involved in its creation, not simply that he was a member after it had been created. Now, at that time, Mahler and members of the RAF actually went to Palestinian camps for training, because at the very outset, the RAF was extremely anti-Israeli and was naturally supporting not just the PLO, but the hijackers of the, you know, the National Front for Liberation of Palestine, George Habash's group, better known as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So they had very much both propaganda and sort of support for armed struggle. They very much backed these policies, and they tried to enact these policies back in Germany. Now, what happened is actually very interesting. Mahler was arrested by the police, and it's believed that he was basically snitched out by an informer. And he was one of the first people, very prominent people from the RAF, to go to jail. So he was in jail, actually, during the I think it was either 1976 or 1977 raid on Mogadishu, when members of the Red Army faction hijacked an Israeli plane in order to get people out of jail. Actually, I think I'm wrong about that. I think it was actually the raid on Entebbe. There was another attack on Mogadishu as well. Now, the thing that made Mahler actually very prominent is that he was one of the, in fact, he was the only prisoner, RAF prisoner in jail, to say that he did not want to leave jail in any kind of hostage exchange deal. And the reason was that, as Mahler told me, when he was in jail, he considered himself a very serious Marxist-Leninist and read an enormous amount, including the works of Gramsci, and Mahler also said the entire works of Hegel. And by reading Gramsci, Mahler turned more against the idea of using terrorism as a political tool. And so he became, to many people, a sort of a sympathetic figure in that he had gone through a terrorist phase, but had decided to renounce it. And he essentially served his entire sentence. I think he served about 10 years before being released from prison. Now, as a result of his stand against terrorism, which is somewhat ironic given his current worldview, where he's almost reverted to his earlier support of armed struggle, he was befriended by people who later became extremely prominent in the German government, two of which I'll just name, one being Gerhard Schroeder and the other being Oskar Schily. Now,
By the way, of course, Gerhard Schroeder was recently re-elected Chancellor of Germany, and Otto Schily is the Interior Minister, correct?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and actually with both Schily and Schroeder, they played a very prominent role with Mahler in an ironic way when I was actually in Germany, because Schily's ministry had put in many informers in Mahler's party, the NPD, and so Mahler is continually in the headlines because of this question of the NPD, which the government has been trying to ban.
And the NPD, we should probably clarify for the audience, is arguably the top German neo-Nazi party. It's not a far-left party such as...
No, not at all. No, exactly. Yeah, no, it's an extreme right party. It's an extreme right party. I fear I'm getting a little bit ahead of my tale, so let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
When Mahler gets released from jail. Now, at that time, Mahler, after he left the RAF, he somewhat declared himself a Maoist and adopted much more conventional kind of Maoist, Orthodox, Marxist-Leninist politics. But after he got out of jail, he realized he had to go back and make a living, and he essentially worked as a paralegal while trying to get his legal right to practice law reinstated. And when, for example, it was Schroeder, who at that time was a leading figure inside the Berlin wing of the SPD, Schroeder was Mahler's lawyer in Mahler's appeal to regain his right to practice law, which actually was successful. I think this occurred sometime in the late 80s, I think like 1987 or 1988. So at that point, the saga of Horst Mahler seemed to be pretty much finished, that he'd gone from a cycle of a radical new leftist into terrorism, spent many years in jail, while in jail sort of wised up and renounced terrorism of all sorts, became a sort of an odd figure because he made it known that he was absolutely infatuated with Hegel. And he, when you talk with Mahler, you continually are bumping into Mahler's take on Hegel.
Kevin, briefly, particularly for younger people, I wonder, you mentioned Gramsci and Hegel. I wonder if you could just give us, if possible, give us a thumbnail synopsis.
Antonio Gramsci was a well-known Italian Marxist theoretician who spent many years in jail under Mussolini. And while in jail, he wrote something called The Prison Notebooks. And in The Prison Notebooks, he reflects on different strategies. He reflects on the failure of the Italian left. And he also writes about Hegel. And his writings on Hegel were also very influential for Mahler. Now, Hegel, in turn, was a German philosopher who died, I think, in 1831 and developed a very important philosophical system, which some people called dialectics,
right,
that was sort of adopted in a curious way by Karl Marx.
How would one synopsize the concept of a dialectic?
Basically, it's the idea that everything is really in a form of transition, and that there is a pattern of change, of changing of substance through what people sometimes call thesis, antithesis, and then a sort of a higher level of a synthetic overcoming of those limitations into a new idea. I mean, this is the most kind of basic way you can discuss Hegelianism, but people talk about it as a kind of a triad of evolution of thought. And the idea that, and Marx's idea was, again, this is very, very vulgarized, but Marx's idea was that Hegel's idea of progress in the intellectual field could be reflected as progress in social thought. So in Marx's idea, for example, the conflict between, say, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie would ultimately result in a higher synthesis, which would be socialism or communism. So Hegel was an extremely important figure for Marx, and Marx in his youth was known as a very prominent young Hegelian. So Gramsci, as a follower of Marx, was necessarily influenced by Hegel, as are all Marxists.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. And now again, Mahler drew to a certain extent on Hegel and Gramsci. And he was doing some time in prison for working with the Red Army faction and or Baader-Meinhof gang. And you mentioned I'd like to draw some connecting links between some of these people and some people whose names crop up also in connection with September 11th. One of the people who Horst Mahler was connected up with, and someone we've spoken about in past discussions, was George Habash. You alluded to him in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Yes.
I wonder if you could sort of triangulate for us George Habash, François Genoux, and Jacques Vergès, all names we've spoken about in the past, but this is going to lead us forward to another conduit leading to the discussion of September 11th.
Yes. The basic connection there, this is a sort of an ugly triad, is that Jacques Vergès is also a radical French Marxist lawyer. He, in turn, under the idea of anti-imperialism and the idea that essentially anyone who was opposed to the United States had some redeeming value, was willing to make an alliance with people on the extreme right and also people in the most extreme wing of the Palestinian movement, which was the people like Habash, who headed up what was called the Rejectionist Front. And the Rejectionist Front was actually the rejection of any idea of a mediated deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So the Habash group was actually very critical of the PLO and of Arafat and saw him as sort of as a centrist leader. So it's almost as if the extremes saw themselves having links between shared links over the whole question of being very anti-American. Now, into this picture plops François Genoux, because Genoux had been a friend of Vergès during a very early period in the early 1960s, during the period of the fight in Algeria for the Algerian independence from France. Vergès was defending various Algerians who were accused by the French of involvement in terrorism, including, you know, bombings of cafes and hotels and public places of transport, at the same time that Genoux was helping to smuggle weapons into the FLN to fight against the French. And so their pact and this idea of a kind of a far left meets far right process really, you can date it back in this question really to Algeria, which means that it begins in the 1960s, in the early 1960s. It then most prominently surfaced in 1969, 1970, when Vergès began defending some hijackers who had hijacked a plane who had then been arrested in Switzerland, and the hijackers were members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Genoux, who lives in Switzerland, used Vergès as the lawyer to defend the hijackers. Now, the third and probably the most famous point when the two of them surface comes in actually with the famous trial of Klaus Barbie in France in the 1980s. And this is the trial that Genoux financed the defense of Klaus Barbie and actually hired Vergès to be Barbie's lawyer.
Parenthetically, Klaus Barbie, of course, the former Gestapo chief of Lyon, France, during World War II, known as the Butcher of Lyon.
Right.
So again, this is an interesting person to see grouped, at least in the same north pasture, so to speak, as George Habash from a political standpoint. Go ahead.
And I think the important framing of this is that when one looks at Mahler, it isn't simply that Mahler is a completely unique individual. We've seen this pattern before.
A number of conduits running forward to the present time. Now, we were alluding to Mahler and the NPD, arguably the top German neo-Nazi party. One of the people who was associated with Mahler and the NPD is Ahmed Huber, a person we've spoken about in our last conversation.
Yes, Ahmed Huber actually has become a prominent speaker in extreme right-wing forums, and especially with the NPD. And, for example, Huber, in early September, actually right before September 11th, Huber was brought by the NPD to a big conference of sort of skinheads. It was a youth conference of the NPD, where he gave a very prominent presentation. And in that presentation, which is also on the web, was reprinted in the NPD youth paper, I think it's called Deutsche Stimme, German Voice. He praised the Iranian government for embracing the Holocaust denial movement. And he argued that the far right in Europe essentially had to overlook its hatred of foreign immigrants, namely Muslims, to rise above that in a sense and make an alliance with the Arab world under the premise that after the radical right or the Islamist right in the Arab world takes power, the immigration or the immigrants from Europe, from the Arab world, will basically be forced back, will be repatriated to the Middle East. And in Huber's line, he doesn't say they'll be thrown out. He says, well, they'll be so overjoyed that these Islamist governments have finally taken power, they will willingly leave Europe and return to the Middle East.
Of course, we spoke about Huber in connection with Al-Taqwa or Nahda management. And that, in turn, is a growing focal point in connection with September 11th and other related terrorist investigations. Both Huber and, I believe, to a certain extent, Nahda actually had contact with François Genoux, did they not?
Yes. Well, Huber told me that he met Genoux on a regular basis. He said that he would... Huber lives in Bern, and Genoux lived in Luzon, so it's probably like maybe an hour and a half train ride away. And they would meet every Thursday. And sometimes he said they would meet just by themselves, sometimes they would meet with their wives, and sometimes they would meet with a group of people. But they made it a regular point to have contact with each other.
François Genoux, by the way, if this seems obscure or irrelevant to some people, he not only was a key Nazi operative before and during World War II, but involved with the Odessa Network, helped to finance Eichmann's trial, and was actually the heir to the literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. So this is a significant, a little recognized figure in the history of the Third Reich.
I think the other important fact about Genoux is that Genoux was a person who didn't have a problem working with a fellow like Jacques Vergès. In other words, Genoux was a person who had no hesitation in courting extremism of almost any variety as long as it agreed with his geopolitical major goal, which was basically opposition to the United States.
Jacques Vergès, too, has a law partner, Isabelle Couton-Père. Tell us a little bit about her, and she also has emerged in connection with some of the figures being investigated in September 11th.
Well, Couton-Père is sort of a fascinating figure, almost as a symbol of this odd terrorist right meets left alliance. Primarily, she is today the lawyer for Carlos the Jackal. Now, if you remember, Carlos was a very important terrorist of the 1970s, And it later turned out that Carlos had been protected when he was living in East Germany and in other East Bloc countries from arrest, primarily because the governments of the East Bloc had a courtesy agreement with groups like the PFLP not to interfere with their affairs. Now, Carlos was arrested, I believe, in the Sudan by French Secret Service agents in the 1990s, and then brought back for trial to Paris, and he was, you know, convicted and is now serving a life sentence. Coutin Père, who was from Jacques Vergès' law firm, not only became Carlos's lawyer, but is now planning, I don't know if they've done it or not, but she announced that she and Carlos plan to get married.
Which is sort of an interesting thing. One wonders, you know, as I've joked about on the air in the past, what is it about Carlos that appeals to her? Is it the money or the hot sex or the fame? You know, I mean, it's interesting. Isabel Coutant-Père is also the French attorney for Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker in connection with September 11th.
Yes, and one of the mysteries that we just don't know is who made the connection to put her to approach her to be his attorney.
Oh, Kevin. By the way, you know, parenthetically, this is something we hadn't spoken about, but and I haven't mentioned it on the air. I saw in this weekend's papers that Carlos the Jackal's brother was just named basically the top energy post of Venezuela this past weekend.
You know, there's a very funny footnote here in that. The head of Venezuela, Chavez, Hugo Chavez, is a big Carlos fan, and he actually writes Carlos letters. They have a kind of a dear Carlos, dear Hugo letter-writing relationship. I mean, Chavez is a very eccentric person, and no more eccentric in his embrace of Carlos the Jackal. Remember, it's important to remember that Carlos actually comes from Venezuela.
Right, and I guess his name is Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, and that is one of Lenin's name, and I guess his brother is named Lenin.
Yes, yeah. Carlos's father was a communist, and named the brothers after figures in the Russian Revolution.
Do you see a certain amount of continuity between, and I guess, obviously I do, but between the compulsive anti-Americanism that's evident, obviously, in the political ideology of someone like Carlos, and obviously people like Janu, Mahler, and Huber, and also Hugo Chavez, who's been very critical of the United States as well. By the way, we're adjusting our gain here, even as I speak, so this is some... over-the-counter radio.
Sure.
But do you think that is a factor here?
Well, I think it definitely plays a very strong role. And one of the things that struck me when I was speaking with Mahler is time and time again he would use analogies from the 1960s. Even though Mahler today portrays himself as a far-rightist and is, in fact, a far-rightist, he would talk about, you know, Che Guevara, you know, war of the peasantry against the imperial enemy, and he would continually use references to, say, the war in Vietnam and other national liberation-type struggles in the 1960s in talking with me. And it seemed very clear that a lot of his political thinking was rigidly fixed against America as the prime enemy of the world in the 1960s, and then it revitalized or took a new form in the 1990s, but America still remained the main enemy. I mean, it's very curious. I'll also give you another example of this. What Mahler and some other people, Mahler is not the only far leftist to go over to the far right. Another fellow named Ren Rabehl, Rahbehl, and he had been a very close friend of Rudi Dutschke, who was the leader of German SDS.
I'm also known as Red Rudy.
Correct? Red Rudy.
Yep.
And Red Rudy became famous because in 1967 there was an attempted assassination of Dutschke by a far-rightist who shot him in the head. And although Dutschke survived, he continually had epileptic seizures because of the injury, and it finally killed him. I think he died in maybe 1979, 1980. But what's happened most recently is that people like Horst Mahler and Rabehl, who actually did know Dutschke in German SDS in Berlin in the 1960s, they tried very strongly to portray Dutschke as actually a kind of an original third positionist. In other words, somebody who would embrace their politics today. Now, the irony of ironies is that it turned out that Dutschke's wife was an American, and so he was definitely not anti-American. And after they tried to,
maybe that's why he was anti-American. I'm joking.
No, they said together. They said together. I mean, she wrote, and other people, not just his wife, but other people, you know, really very much attacked this attempt to sort of ideologically reposition Dutschke as a prototype of somebody who would support a alliance between the far right and the far left against the United States. But this has very deep roots in German politics, and it also has deep roots in the attempt of people within the far right to promote the certain ideas that were ideas current during the time of the Nazis within the far right, but never gained hegemony under Hitler. And what I speak of, for example, I speak of a concept called National Bolshevism. And National Bolshevism was an idea that came out of the far right. People like Ernst Jünger, who was a very famous German right-wing author from the 1920s and 1930s, and other people as well. And their idea was that Germany and Russia should join in a pact basically against the Anglo-Saxon nations. This was a sort of an ideological echo of the ideas that Karl Haushofer and the geopoliticians also advanced during the 1920s and 1930s. Now, as we know only too well, when Hitler came to power, the relations between Russia and Germany dramatically deteriorated because Hitler was obviously cracking down the Communist Party, playing a very big anti-communist card, and threw many, communists into concentration camps. And so the National Bolshevik argument never took place. It never grew. It never took a place of prominence in either the 1920s or the 1930s. But today, and really starting from the 1980s, there's been a very strong attempt by elements in the right, both in Germany and, not surprisingly, in Russia, to develop this trend, National Bolshevism, as one of their major ideas. And so we've seen recently people like Alexander Dugin, who is an important figure in the Russian far right. He may be one of the most important figures in the Russian far right. He also has a post, he's an official advisor, I believe, to the head of the Russian parliament. At the same time,
Kevin, you know, yep. I'm going to interrupt just ever so briefly here. We're going to turn over our tape because we're almost out of time. I've been speaking with Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International, published in softcover by autonomedia.org. I want to remind listeners of Spitfire and their website, www.spitfirelist.com. It's equipped with real audio, and there'll be a detailed annotated description of this program in the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Also, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs at a longer URL link to both the WFMU website and to the Spitfire website. Note, by the way, that Kevin's book was edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at WFMU. We've been visiting with Kevin Coogan. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 383, being recorded on October 14th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.